You're this morning's bad penny, Mr. Gray. Yeah. Keep turning up. Welcome back.
One last time today. I'll be back later. Okay. But, again, for the record, Casey Granis, on behalf of appellant Aaron Howerton. I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal in this case. Mr. Howerton challenges the denial of his criminal rule 7.8 motion to get a new trial for his conviction on aggravated murder. The threshold issue in this case is a procedural one. The trial court determined that the motion was time-barred by statute, and the state on appeal presses that argument. Howerton responds to it and argues today that he exercised reasonable diligence in filing this motion under the circumstances. And when we determining whether the motion is time barred requires more than just looking at the simple passage of time. And in this case, the information was first, new evidence at issue was first conveyed to Howerton in 2008. The witness, Jody McAllister, had issued, furnished a written statement in 2009. The 7A motion wasn't filed until, I believe, 2015. So, yes, there's a number of years that have passed. But when we're looking at reasonable diligence and a filing, that's we look at the particular circumstances of the case. What's going on? Why did it take so long to file that motion? Basically, Howerton has advanced two arguments in support of his argument that the petition or the motion is not time barred. One is that the witness at issue, Jody McAllister, suffered from these mental infirmities that prevented her from being available as a witness in support of the 7A motion for a prolonged period of time. And it wasn't until 2015 that she essentially became available. Her mental condition had improved.
That's one witness to a conversation. The other witness to a conversation is Officer Bricker. So there's two key witnesses. If this is key evidence, there are two key witnesses. However, by waiting to file the petition, the circumstance arose that Bricker died.
That's true.
And so, how do we measure, in looking at all of the circumstances, how do we measure the impact on the truth-seeking function of a post-trial collateral review versus the original trial, where everybody was alive at the time of the original trial, but now a key witness is dead if there were to be another trial, when we're looking at whether diligence was exercised? And the reason I ask it is because surely, if everyone was alive and still mentally acute, one of the things that you would be favoring me with is the argument that it doesn't matter that it took so long because everybody can still testify to everything they know. But here, conversely, one person to a conversation that's alleged to have occurred is deceased. So how does that factor in?
Well, when we're looking at reasonable diligence in filing the motion, I don't know. I'm having trouble linking up the death of Bricker early on in this process.
No, two years after the information came out.
2 years. With the exercise of reasonable diligence. And I say that because, I mean, this type of scenario, as far as I know, hasn't arose in the case law. I mean, so it's a fair question to wrestle with. But my sense is that when we're looking at reasonable diligence, it's focused on what is known to the person tasked with filing the collateral attack, the circumstances or the potential impediments to filing that motion. Bricker's death certainly is unfortunate in the sense that, yes, he's no longer available as a witness, but if the reasonable diligence factor is focused on the person that has to do the filing, I don't see how that factors into that, because it's not as if Howerton knew or Witchley knew or Crowley knew that Booker was going to pass away in 2010. Well,
why do you suppose that we care at all whether there was diligence? Why is it even a consideration?
Because the trial court ruled that the 7A motion was time barred, and so I.
No. I don't mean in this case. I mean generally. Why is there such a requirement?
Well, the requirement has to do with. I mean, the 1-year time bar exists for various policy reasons.
Why do we care about time bars, and why do we care about reasonable diligence?
Finality is one of the main reasons why a time bar
exists.
That's
the only thing is finality?
No, not the only thing, but it's balanced against. I mean, the time bar is balanced against.
Isn't the concern that if people sit on their rights and time goes by, that the longer that goes by, the harder it is to have an effective truth-seeking process?
That's one of the considerations. I agree with that, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But that's why we look to the particular circumstances.
So,
I mean, if Howerton
so,
that.
So there must be something more to diligence than just a focus on one person. There must be a focus on the circumstances, right? What's it's reasonable under the prevailing circumstances.
Yes, what's reasonable under the prevailing circumstances. But then that's tied to, okay, when is that motion getting filed? When is it? And if it's not getting filed within that 1-year time bar, why isn't it? And that's why I'm relying on, again, the two-pronged argument. One is that the key witness.
Well, we know here because the trial was in 95 and the conversation was more than a decade later, so more than a year had gone by. So it.
Well, yes, we get so newly that discovered evidence.
I get that part, yeah.
Yes, I mean, this is newly discovered evidence, and it's from the time that the evidence was newly discovered to the time of the filing that's at issue here in terms of reasonable diligence. The fact is that Howerton's key witness on that, Howerton's witness, just wasn't available due to mental infirmity until later on. And if this court does not agree with that argument, then Howerton has alternatively raised the issue that he hired counsel to timely file this motion and didn't get filed ineffective assistance. Thank you.
And we'll revisit that in 10 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Kathleen Weber, and I represent the State. This is an appeal from a collateral attack on a conviction for aggravated first-degree murder where the conviction occurred in 1995. And I don't think you've hit the button to make my time go down.
I was just so fascinated by what you were telling me.
I'm glad to hear that.
There we go.
It presents actually two issues. The one that we focused on this morning is, of course, the time bar issue and to what extent the defendant should have been excused from his delay in bringing new information to the court 7 years after he obtained it. There's, of course, the statute that does give the defendant the excuse from the 107390 090 time bar if on the basis of newly discovered evidence, but it is qualified on the basis that the defendant must not only discover the evidence by using diligence, but he must also present it to the court by using diligence. I don't want to talk about the discovery issue because this is a Brady violation and those have special circumstances. What I want to talk about is the diligence in getting the case before the court, notifying the state that we have this new evidence that bears on the reliability of my conviction and I believe I should get a new trial because of this new evidence. 1073-100 sub 1 is the legislature's recognition that everybody, the defendant and the public, have an interest in accurate adjudications. It's also a recognition that by placing that due diligence standard on the defendant, that evidence is not like a fine wine. It doesn't get better as time goes on. And if you have new evidence, you also have the obligation, if you want the court to do something about that, to get that before the court so that it can be investigated and it can be presented and it can be vetted to determine whether or not it actually is something that is material to the defense and does justify a new trial. As the court has noted and as the state has pointed out, one of the big problems in this circumstance was that the defendant waited to present this to the court until after one of the key witnesses to the allegation, Detective Bricker, had died. Now, Jody McAllister says she told Detective Bricker that the co-defendant Barnes said to her that he was the shooter, not Aaron Howerton. In fact, Jody can't really provide anything with respect to what happened with Aaron Howerton regarding his connection with this case, which is a different issue. But there really are only two witnesses. The mother, Linda McAllister, wasn't present for those conversations between Jody and Detective Bricker, just Jody and Detective Bricker. And Bricker is gone now. We've forever lost the ability to question Detective Bricker and find out whether or not she, in fact, did tell him that. What we do have is circumstantial evidence presented by two officers who had been previously employed by the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office and two officers who had been previously employed by the Snohomish City Police Department, which indicate that that never did happen. And ultimately, that's what the trial court found.
Let me take you back to the more theoretical.
Okay.
Away from the fact findings. I know there's a fact that was found in your favor in terms of that. But it makes sense that the death of a key witness would be a circumstance that should be considered. Intuitively, it seems impossible that there's never been that this has never happened before. That there's never been a case where there was a delay and a key witness became unavailable through whatever calamity, permanently unavailable, such that it would affect the truth-seeking function. But you don't cite us a case that has that fact pattern. Is there one? Am I just making it up?
No, you're not making it up, and it's not something that I have been able to find. I think the closest analogy is the Wheeler case that I cited to the court, where the defendant asserted essentially a good cause basis for bringing his claim 5 or 7 years after the fact, which is similar to what Mr. Howerton is bringing in this case. Well, I had a witness who wasn't really coherent for a long time and really couldn't give the court a coherent statement. When we stuck her on the stand, even though she had given a coherent statement in a written statement in 2009 that was notarized, I mean, the suggestion that Mr. Crowley had to confirm that Jody wrote that, I think, is a little far afield because it's notarized. That's the point of notarizing a statement. But certainly, he had a problem. I mean, he had a witness that is saying one thing in a written statement and saying, but she just can't get to court and explain that coherently because she's so drug-addled until 2015 or 2016 when the hearing was actually held. Wheeler essentially says, we don't care. You don't get a chance to wait till your evidence gets better. You have an obligation to bring that to the court now so that we can look at it now. And if need be, we can continue the matter in order for you to be able to present your case. But you need to at least notify the state so the state can investigate this and determine this. You can't just sit on your rights. That's just like latches. You can't sit on your rights to the prejudice of another person, of the opposing side. And again, the point of the whole due diligence thing is because it doesn't, if the defendant were successful in pressing his Brady claim, and if the court had determined that these defense witnesses were credible and that, you know, the state withheld evidence to the defendant's detriment and he was entitled to a new trial, the state is in a terrible position at this point because it's 23 years later now. And witnesses lose their, you know, they lose their ability to recount details. That's obviously clear from Jody. I mean, you don't know if you're going to even be able to find some of these witnesses, regardless of whether they're dead or not. But it puts us in a much more tenuous position of being able to determine the truth of what Mr. Howerton's involvement in this aggravated murder was 23 years later. So, you know, counsel started talking a little bit about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which is sort of the flip side of this, well, we had this good cause reason to delay. But, hey, if you don't buy that, my attorney was ineffective. He didn't provide effective representation to me, and so therefore, for some reason, the court should waive the time bar. I'm not aware of any cases that say ineffective assistance of counsel is a basis on which to waive a statutory time bar. But certainly, if the court were to consider ineffective assistance...
Well, isn't the issue something different that... that there is no right to counsel for to assist in the filing of a petition?
That's correct.
And if there is no right to counsel, then how can there be a right to effective counsel?
That's correct,
and
Your Honor.
And if it only applied to people with means who could retain counsel, then they would, by some device, have a right that isn't provided by the Constitution to people without means, and that seems to be not probably the right answer.
That's correct, Your Honor. And also, I would point out that there's a case that I unfortunately did not cite to the court. It's the Bonds case, In re Bonds at 165 Washington 2nd, 135. That was an equitable tolling case. But in that case, the court pointed out that even though the defendant time for filing his collateral attack elapsed before the chief judge found that it was not frivolous, he was not entitled to add a new issue on the basis of equitable tolling because he could have, as a pro se, filed that. And pro ses are held to the same standard as attorneys in this regard. Just finally on that particular issue as well, I mean, even if for some reason ineffective assistance of counsel did apply in this context, I mean, it's clear Mr. Crowley and probably Mr. Witchley made a tactical decision. And there wasn't really a lot of case law discussing what due diligence was in the context of these post-conviction motions at the time that they were making the decision. And they had a witness who was just a complete mess. I mean, she really was not able to provide a coherent statement even when we – well, she barely provided a coherent statement at the hearing. But she, I'm sure, based upon the testimony, was a real mess and was not able to accurately relay to the court what she actually did remember from 20 years earlier. With that, I would just ask the court to deny the appeal on the basis that it's time barred and also that there was no Brady violation. Thank you.
Clearly, one of the issues on the court's mind is the death of Detective Richter and how that factors into the analysis on the time bar issue. As I'm sitting there listening to the state present its argument, I'm trying to think of a scenario that would help to illuminate the point that I'm trying to make on that issue. Suppose, for example, that... new evidence was discovered by Howerton. It was divulged. Howerton promptly, when I say promptly, I mean, let's say within a few months, files that 7-8 motion. So we're dealing with the hypothetical line, just to illuminate a point. Now, in that interim, between learning of the new evidence and filing that motion, Detective Bricker, key witness, passes away, unfortunately. Now, in that scenario, that triggers the same concerns about, well, the 7-8, you know, the collateral attack is, you know, it's supposed to be about the truth-seeking function of the process, and, you know, Bricker's death, you know, impinges upon that. But in that situation, it's not laid at the feet of Howerton in terms of whether he acted with reasonable diligence or not in filing that petition. It's just what happened. It's an effect on the process. But when we're looking... But because that effect, I mean, that effect could exist whether or not Howerton promptly filed that 7-8 motion or waited years down the line to file the 7-8 motion. when we're looking at the reasonable diligence standard, that's what I'm talking about. Well, they should be focused on the steps that were taken, whether the petitioner, the movement, took the reasonably diligent steps to file the motion. Whether Dr. Pricker passed away, yes, that's an effect. That's a fact. But it doesn't really enter into that more specific inquiry of whether reasonable diligence was exercised here. And
it has to have occurred to all of us that for someone in prison, Mr. Howerton was extraordinarily patient, waiting 7 years for something to happen. That's not usual in and of itself, that degree of patience.
Yeah, he was patient. He was patient with his lawyers to do what needed to be done to his detriment so far. And again, that goes at the ineffective assistance claim. I understand Your Honor's point. There's no right to counsel at the filing stage of a collateral attack, so therefore, how can it be ineffective assistance? Let's just run with that in the final few seconds. Okay, so there's no right to effective assistance. Let's just put that to the side. Fact still remains that counsel was retained. Counsel was dilatory. By retaining counsel, there's an implicit assurance that the attorney's going to do his job and getting the thing done before the time bar kicks in. That didn't happen here. If nothing else, equitable tolling should apply. Thank you.
Thank you.